If I'd been as much of a twat as people seem to think, I wouldn't still be working on the radio. The BBC should have really strong local radio stations, and I could sort it out in a day. When you're told you're probably going to die, there is a kind of calmness that comes over you.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. James Whale.
I was Michael, and I grew up in a middle-class suburban suburb of London, which, well, it used to be a village called Ewell, E-W-E-W, a very nice, very pretty place. And my grandparents lived in the house adjoining ours, so it was all that sort of, you know, and we lived there, two-bedroom, semi-detached house. I failed the 11 plus, and I went to the little local school. I failed the 11 plus and told my mother I would never go to school again. That was it. I'm never going back. Obviously, that wasn't the case. I ended up going to Linton's Lane Secondary Modern in Epsom, which had a reputation for being one of the toughest and roughest schools, with boys from the council estate on Epsom Downs who used to end up as stable lads in the stables around the Derby. So I ended up going there and adopting a sort of way of talking a bit like this, because otherwise I got beaten and smashed up all the time. And obviously having to change as soon as I went home. So I had a bit of a schizophrenic school life. Yeah, I can say without any shadow of doubt, I didn't enjoy any of my school life at all. My saving grace was because not only was I not very good at schoolwork, I wasn't very good at sport either. But I was a good fantasist. And I liked playing cowboys and Indians and shooting and, you know, all that sort of. So I took up archery. I became the Surrey Junior Champion. And that was about it. And then I thought I'd get into the Olympics, because archery was just coming back into the Olympics, and that didn't happen.
From now on, the pound abroad is worth 14% or so less in terms of other currencies. That doesn't mean, of course, that the pound here in Britain, in your pocket or purse or in your bank, has been devalued.
My dad then lost his job because Harold Wilson had his squeeze on the economy, and lots of small businesses, of which my dad and his dad and his dad's brothers ran a little habit. Well, it was if you ever remember the rag trade, it was a business like that. They made dresses and blouses and overalls and pinafores and all that sort of, you know, 1950s sort of stuff. And S&R Whale, which was situated on Railton Road in Brixton. The firm went broke. He lost his job, had to sell the house. Right at the time I was about to leave school, I was told to go my last year at school between 15 and 16. I hardly ever turned up. They said, oh, you know, don't worry, because you're obviously not going to pass any exams. You might as well. And I spent most of it in the swimming pool. My dad wanted to be a publican. He should always have been a publican, because he was a brilliant publican, and he decided he wanted to get a pub with my mum. And so he worked in the pub in Ewell Village for a little while, getting the idea, and then they sold the house and bought a pub. But unfortunately, they bought a pub in King's Cross, because I thought they'd buy one in the country with roses round the door and all that sort of stuff. I stayed with my grandmother. I said, I'm not moving out there. When I left school, I went to work for a friend of my dad's who had a building firm, and I stayed there for the summer of 68, I think, doing nothing in particular, sort of leaning on shovels and eyeing up girls and all that sort of, you know, sort of stuff. And then my mother said, well, what are you going to do for the rest of it? And I wanted to be an actor. But my mother was a professional ballet dancer. She was in the Ballet Rombert and the International Ballet, and she was a ballet dancer, or had been a ballet dancer. And she said, you're not going to join that. You're not going into acting. There's some very funny, strange people in acting. As in all these businesses, you've got to keep well away from those sort of people. You need to get a proper job. So I'd gone up to the pub and I'd thought, oh, this isn't, you know, this is, I could walk from my dad's pub to Tottenham Court Road in 10 minutes. And of course, this was a time when we were listening to the pirate radio stations and they were all on them.
That's East West there. Very unusual record, I won, for Herman and the Hermits. And I think it's going to do very well for him.
I predict it. 15 this week in our fabulous 48 and a quarter.
And it was the sort of 67, 68, 69. And it was a time when London was swinging, if you want to use that term. And I found a little club called the Marquee Club in Wardour Street. And I. So anyway, my mother said, I've arranged for you to go for an interview at Harrods. I was a trainee buyer in Harrods. I was having quite a good time, really, because I used to live King's Cross. Well, it was more Holborn than King's Cross. It was between King's Cross and Holborn. It was pretty rough area, has to be said, with pretty interesting people, but I loved it. So then I suddenly had met somebody in Harrods who was a DJ. It wasn't really, I can't even remember his name, but he was going on about being a disc jockey in the clubs. He'd come down from up north, and I'd never met a northerner before. It was quite interesting. We went to the Marquee a lot, and to the 100 Club in Oxford Street, and to a couple of clubs in the King's Road, and I thought, I want to be a DJ. And I was a big fan, of course. So, I mean, my heroes were people like Tony Blackburn and Johnny Walker and Tony Windsor. I don't know if you remember, Tony Windsor was a big... He was a, hello!
Hello, best wishes. And first thing Monday morning, the Radio London Club Disc of the Week will be posted to you with the compliments of the club, and you'll hear it at the end of...
He had a very sad end, Tony Windsor, and ended up for a while working for my dad as a barman in the pub. You know, I wanted to be a rock star like everybody in the 60s, but I can't sing and I can't play an instrument. And I loved the radio. I had these little kits you could buy with printed circuits. You could make your own radios. And I used to listen to them, and I used to love Book at Bedtime. And I used to love listening to Luxembourg when you could get it and it fade in and out. And that was brilliant. Paul Burnett and David Jensen, of course, who was my age. He was the baby on the radio.
That's the eternal triangle there on the Decca label and a brand new single called I Guess the Lord Must Be in New York City. And right now on 208 on a Friday night, it's 8:30.
Bingo, bingo, I'm in love.
And, well, that does just bring us to the end of the Bingo Scoop Show. We'll be broadcasting another game tomorrow night, so good luck until then.
I thought this is brilliant, and that's what I thought I might like to do. Well, interestingly enough, I wasn't doing terribly well in Harrods because my mind wandered quite a lot. I kept seeing well-known people I'd seen on the television wandering around, and I thought, what a great job. All you do, you sit on the TV and then you wander around to Harrods. Why am I standing doing this? I don't want to do that. Anyway, in the end, I got sacked from Harrods for leaving my till, and they were making a TV commercial in the food hall, and I'd wandered off to watch it because I was fascinated. So I was watching that, and somebody couldn't find where I was, and the till was locked, and I... Anyway. So, my dad was, his pub was a Watney's pub, and Watney's were just about to open a chain of discotheques, and the Watney's newsletter, I think it was called the Red Barrel, or something, I can't remember. And my dad said, look, you know, you want some DJs? Why don't you, they're running a course for disc jockeys in Twickenham, why don't you have a shot? I said, I've never done anything in front of people, I can't do that. But anyway, I went off because my mum said, you've got to get a job. Now, if you don't like that, you can go to another shop or blah, blah, blah. So I went off to do this audition, and loads of people went. And for some reason, they said, but they picked a load of people and called us back to go and get some training. And I was one of them. And I was allocated the Bird's Nest in Muswell Hill. Do you know, I can remember the first day and thinking, Mrs. We had to play music like Burt Camford, and they actually, and you know, different songs, and they programmed everything you did. It was like being on a radio station. You sat in a little booth, a bit like the studio we're in now, and looked out to the dance floor. And I actually remember it was all very boring and not like it was on the radio, and certainly not like the nights I'd spent in the Marquee, and it was dull. And I just remember having Marvin Gaye, and I heard it through the grapevine coming on. And people have been saying, and now, Mr. Marvin Gaye from Motown, and I heard it through the grapevine. And I, you know, I listened to Tony Blackburn on those, and I suddenly sort of realised, so I talked over the introduction, which they told you shouldn't really do in the dance floor, it will ruin all the dancing. So I'd hit the vocal, and I was really quite good. I suddenly remember it clicking in my mind, how to be a DJ, how to introduce a record. So that went on for quite some time. I even was sent over to Sweden to work in a club over there for Watney's, a bird's nest they opened up there for a couple of months. I did a lunchtime session at the Bird's Nest in Waterloo, which is around about 5 minutes walk from where we're sitting now. And then I realised I might have to do some other stuff, and I thought I'd become an actor. I had met Melinda, my wife, and for some strange reason, she got pregnant at the age I was 19, and we were in all sorts of trouble at that particular time. I thought I'd better get a serious job, so I went and took some acting lessons and got into rep and did that for a little while. and realised I wasn't earning any money in rep, and it was pretty, and Melinda was living with my parents. We were sort of living in one room in the pub with two children. So I came back and I got some more work as a DJ. And then we were out, you know, as she and I were wandering around Oxford Street, just ambly wandering along, pushing the buggy with young James in the buggy. And we were in Topshop, and I thought, this is like a disco. I bet they could use a DJ here. And so I went to seek out the manager, who was a name called Ralph Halpin, who became quite famous. I think it was five times a night Ralph or something, and as the most highly paid executive of Burton's at one point. But at that time, he was general manager of Topshop. And I went in and said, you need a DJ here, you know, liven the place up, play a few records. And they said, I don't think so, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you never know, leave your number. And I went into a play in Oxford. I'd got a job a couple of weeks as an assistant stage manager. So I went off and did that and got a call. Said, you know, come over and we'll have a chat. And I started Radio Top Shop with them. We had a little studio built. And I thought, I'm just down the road from Radio 1. Everything's sweet. To cut a very long story short, I ended up doing the radio there. Didn't get a job on Radio 1. Earned loads of money doing that. And then walking up to the Sundown Club in Tottenham Court Road, where I was the three nights a week DJ, earning about £75 a night. We're talking in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of money. And then the commercial radio stations went on. So my dad loved Adrian Love, and I'd never heard talk radio before.
Well, 8 minutes past 11, Nightline. We are going to open the lines, because talking...
And when we were sort of closing up the pub, when I was, I'd be helping my dad close the pub, and we'd have it on in the background. I thought that was really quite fun, but I didn't think any more about it. And so I tried to get some work, and I was interviewed on LBC by a big fat chap with glasses whose name I can't remember, did a late night show as London's premier store DJ, and I can't remember that. Anyway, that's what I was. But eventually, I started going for auditions for the commercial radio stations. I went to see Keith Skews at Radio Hallam, and then I went to Metro Radio. I went to all of them. I didn't really get much feedback there, but I'd done an audition for Metro, and I was sitting in, Melinda and I, by this time, I got a council flat in the East End of London, on the 18th floor of a tower block, which is quite interesting and fairly surreal. And I was just thinking to myself, what can I do to get... I was about 20 at the time. And I started ringing the people I met at the radio station. I have this great idea. They'll all need to have a correspondent in London who can go and do an interview or something and sell it back to them. And so the first person on my list was a guy called Peter Lewis, who ran Metro Radio with his dad, Bruce Lewis, at the time.
This is Bruce Lewis saying welcome to Metropolitan Broadcasting. We are now going on the air for the very first time.
He was a TV continuity announcer, I think, anyway. So I rang up and said, look, you know, I saw you the other day and blah, blah, blah. Because when we had the audition, I remember it was in a disco, and everything fell apart in the middle of my audition. So I stopped and said, look, I'm sorry, guys, the equipment's not working, blah, blah, blah. And they said, oh, that's part of the audition. We wanted to see what would happen if everything went wrong. And so I said, well, that's a bloody stupid idea. Anyway, so I didn't get up. Yeah. And they said, look, somebody's just fallen out and we really liked your voice. And we like, you know, would you come and work for us? We, you know, we'd offer you a 3-month contract, £50 a week. Bearing in mind, I was earning about 300 quid a week. And that's a lot of money in those days. So I said, really? Okay. We're in Newcastle. Right. Okay. So I moved the family back to the pub because we had a long chat about it. And Melinda said, well, I think it's worth doing. And my dad said, yeah, we'll go on the radio. And I said, well, look, if I go up for 3 months and then I've got 3 months experience, then I can come back and blah, blah, blah. And so I went up for 3 months and the radio station didn't go on the air for all sorts of reasons. So we were all still employed. And they took us around the Northeast. I probably knew the Northeast. I probably now know the Northeast better than most people who were born and bred there. Well, when I first turned up, by the way, the studios were such a state. I walked in and there were builders in the reception area and piles of brick and rubble. And I stood there with two suitcases looking fairly pathetic, I imagine. This bloke, who I thought was a builder, called Neil Robinson, who was actually the... he ended up being the boss of the whole thing. Sadly, he's died, of course. But I remember him coming and said, "Doe, are you? Oh, you're one of them DJs. All right, well, roll your sleeves up and get stuck in. We need to..." And I thought, shit, what have I done? And anyway, eventually we went on the air. I did the early evening news show called Roundup at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I think. And then Maggie Mash, believe it or not, who was one of the other DJs there. Oh, Don Dwyer did the breakfast show from Australia. I wonder what ever happened to him. Giles Squire did a programme called The Jal Show just after lunch. Anyway, and I was doing a bit of news and Sounds in the Night, which was a late night music show, which was all right, I suppose, but I got really very bored with it.
Hello, I'm James Whale, and I'd like to introduce you to the other announcers on Metro. And they are Ladies First.
Hello, I'm Maggie Mash.
And also...
Hello, I'm Peter Raitt.
I mean, Tony Blackburn and Johnny Walker were my DJ heroes, and I suppose I was a bit like them. And they thought I had a very late night voice, so that was most annoying. But anyway, so everything really went tits up, to be honest. And I was doing the nighttime music show, and breakfast show was not rating. Nobody in the Northeast wanted a bloody Australian doing the breakfast show, and he was quite strange. So they offered it to me. But then a guy called John Wellington, who was very friendly with Dave Gregory, went and complained bitterly. He said, James Well's never been on the radio before. James Well has never been on the radio before. You offered him the breakfast show. Dave Gregory has been on Radio 1. He's a great radio guy. I actually sounded a bit like Dave Gregory, but when I went, I decided to be more my theatrical self and how we all spoke in those days. Remember, of course, I changed my voice when I went to school to be a bit... This is my voice, by the way. This sounds like James Whale, doesn't it? Yeah, it is, I mean. So anyway, they gave it to Dave, to the breakfast show. Rest is history. So I did the evening show, and I thought back to Adrian Love, and I thought, this is so boring. I'm going to take phone calls. And I said to the boss, look, I think I'll do a phone-in, because you've got all the equipment. No one does. I'm going to do a phone-in. He said, well, you can do it, so you won't get any calls. He said, quite frankly, we're not, you know, really we're just interested in 6 to 6. But because of our licence, we have to go on. I said, well, that's really nice. OK. And I opened the phone lines. I mean, I'm on my own, remember. No producers or tech ops, and I'm on my own. So I play a record saying, hi, James Whale on Metro, and here's the latest by Lindisfarne and Fog on the Tyne. And you want to give me a call, here's the number, blah, blah, blah. And so I used to run out to the switchboard, line up a number of calls, because loads of calls would come in then, because it was new and modern and, you know... people would rather tweet or text you than get on the phone. So we have to develop a new way of doing it, which I think is quite fun. So you read out people's texts or tweets, aggravate them a little bit, and they ring in. So it works quite well. So one night some bloke rang in, and it's just like it is now in many cases. So a bloke rang in and... Oh, is that James Wheeler? Listen, mate, you're asking what's going wrong with all the business and whether the shipyards are closing? I'll tell you, man, it's the blacks. I said, I beg your pardon. It's them foreigners coming into this country, man. That's what it is. I've never heard anything so ridiculous. You're a racist individual. What a nasty piece of work you are. Do you know, quite frankly, I don't think I'm going to let you on here anymore. I don't know why I said, just how I felt. He said, are you for real? You shouldn't be on the radio. You should. Blah, blah, blah. So I had an argument and cut him off, went on to another call, who actually said, James, that was... I'm so pleased to hear some blah, blah. And then... Some journalists had been listening, or somebody had got onto the front pages of the newspapers, and what was it, the IBA or something like that? They had a complaint, and oh God, it's quite interesting. And then the ratings came out, and I had more ratings on my nighttime show than the bloody breakfast show. So I ended up staying there for about 8 years. You know, we bought a little house, and the kids went to school and got Geordie accents, and. And it wasn't, funnily enough, and Dad and I were going to open a pub in a place called Spennymoor in County Durham. We found a little pub, nice, and he wanted to do, and it would be really nice, but sadly he died behind the bar of his pub, and that kind of threw... It's funny how things happen, isn't it? Because that kind of unsettled me. And I've been doing really well. I've been doing a TV show for Tyne Tees, and even though I was only 28, 29 at the time, I felt I'm getting too old for this. I've got to get a proper job. Life in those days on one of the... And it was a big commercial radio station. Metro was a big station. And you became a personality. And, I was a personality because the programme, I used to call it Night Owls. And I must say that was Dave Gregory's idea. But I liked it, and I had a Night Owls Club, and we had Night Owls nights out. I was quite a big personality in those days in the Northeast. Metro 261. Well, we were all kind of pally, but radio isn't about pals, because you don't really see apart from the person before you or after you. And there was no one after me. We closed down when I finished at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. That I turned the station off. And it went on again at sort of 5:30 with recorded whatever in those days. And it wasn't until, what, about 10 years later that we started going through the night and people realised there's quite a big audience. Because I used to say to people, you know, you go to St. James's Park and there's about 40,000 people in there and people are selling loads of advertising. Well, we've probably got 40,000 people listening at night on the radio and you're all moaning about it's not worth doing. It must be. And of course, I actually, when I started on the radio, there was no third peak. It was drive time, morning. And now everybody realises that 10 o'clock until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning is a prime time, if you handle it right, to be on the radio.
You're a stupid woman. You're a biggest idiot I have.
I've never been as difficult or as unruly as people think. Because if I had been, Howard Stern always said, if I'd been as much of a twat as people seem to think, I wouldn't still be working on the radio, and same with me. I would like to have had a manager, not on the radio station, but somebody directing my career. And I think if I had, I may well have moved back to London after a couple of years. But I had young children in school, and that was kind of important. And I was enjoying being, you know, top dog in a small pond, if you like. Over my career, I'm trying to think when I don't think anybody's ever really given me any great hints or tips. The only thing I can remember is very young interviewing people being told, it's a really good idea if you nod your head and you don't say yes all the time. And that's always stuck with me, because people do, don't they? Say, oh yeah, yeah, and don't, just nod your head. It's not, I've listened a lot to radio over the years, and I've picked up how I want to do it and how I think, and I know what's going to make radio entertaining and what's going to make for the listener. You know, my dad died, and I looked around for another job, and there was a job in broadcast advertising, mid-morning DJ for BBC Radio Derby. And I said to Melinda, I said, what do you think? She said, well, if that's what you want to do. I said, I think it's time for me to be a serious broadcaster. And I might get onto Pebble Mill, because I thought I should perhaps get into television. So I rang up the advert and got through to a secretary who said yes. I said, well, I'm inquiring about the job you've got for mid-morning show. Oh, yeah, well, I think we fill that. Thank you very much indeed. Okay. And just before, some bloke said, who's interested? And she came back and said, excuse me, could you tell me your name? I said, James Whale. James Whale. She said, no. And the bloke comes on the phone. It's John, who happened to be the editor of BBC Newcastle. But I didn't know that. And he changed jobs. He goes, yeah, what? He said, do you want to work on here? Are you sure? I said, well, you know, I think it's time for a change. And I hadn't really, So he said, well, come down and see me. So I went down and they gave me a little script about, and I thought to myself, this is pretty good, because I'm going to learn more stuff, you see. And they liked the way I said, this is BBC Radio Derby. That's how I got the job. That's basically how I got the job. BBC Radio Derby, the BBC from Derbyshire. And they like, oh, that sound like a BBC person, don't I, really? So anyway, I got the job, did the mid-morning show, took a 50% cut in what I was getting paid, which wasn't, you know, I was on about 14,000 a year. 70s, not bad, really, was it? Not, you know, it's okay. And the BBC paid me 8, I think, something like that. I went there and worked there for a year. I hated it. I absolutely detested it. And the reason is, and having recently done quite a big stint on BBC, the reason is the BBC seemed to me to be more interested in pleasing themselves or their management and everything else and not worrying too much about the audience. Though they, I'm sure, would, you know. And if somebody, some old lady or old man complains somewhere, they kind of look at it and get really upset. Where I would say, well, tell them to piss off and let's get the ratings up, you know. But who knows? I mean, the BBC should have really strong local radio stations, and I could sort it out in a day. I'd scrap the music, apart from specialist shows. It'd be all talk. It would do the sort of stuff we couldn't do in commercial radio, and it would find an audience, absolutely find an audience, because there needs to be sort of kind of, you know, something along those lines. Now, I've just proved I've done 3 years doing the breakfast show for BBC Essex, and I more than doubled their audience by getting rid of all the boring BBC stuff like, we'll have a well-crafted package from one of our reporters. Really? Why? It's a radio show, you know. Let's get phoners on. And Lou Burt, who's running it now, knows, because she worked with me at LBC, knows what to do, but I bet the BBC will stamp on her. Which is a shame, because it proves you can do it. You can get people calling in. You don't have to have a different topic every 15 minutes and a recorded package which will make people go and want to slit their wrists. And all you go to one of these, I don't know, media studies and they tell you how to make a nice package to go on the radio. That's dull. It's what's killing radio in this country. That's for Radio 4. No more. Just Radio 4.
Let's move on now to the lady at your side, who's just put her knitting away. What a shame. Miss Beeston. You put your knitting away, Miss Beeston.
And they should stop paying their executives enormous amounts of money and put some of that money in to their local radio stations, and it would work. But do you think they'll do it? No, I don't think so. Not until they change the whole structure of the management of the BBC. Even the people who run the stations. Do you know, it is so fucking stupid that they have an editor on a local radio station reports to a group editor of about four or five stations who then reports to somebody. Why don't they actually start work? Do they have focus groups? I suppose they do, and they get people who go on focus groups are probably just as stupid as the people who run it. It annoys me because it's easily fixed. But what they want to do is pay 50 quid for somebody to present a show, who's not very good anyway. You know, there are good people who could present shows in every area of this country who aren't wanting to be big stars or anything else, and you could find them and they could go on. I'm fed up with it. That's my rant. Because we'll lose the BBC. We should lose the licence fee. It should be included in your council tax like it is in other countries. And they don't need to have an organisation the size of some small country. I got so bored, I ended up going round the country doing commercials because I seem to be able to do commercials quite well. And so lots of radio stations, commercial stations employed you. And I made more money in a day than I made in a week doing that. So I used to get in my car after the show, 10 o'clock in the morning. I drive to Birmingham, I drive to Manchester, I drive to Newcastle, I drive all over the place. People might wonder why I was driving. Well, there weren't things like ISDN lines in your house then or computers or, you know, you had to drive. In fact, when I was doing this right in the early days, there were no bloody mobile phones either. So you had to drive to the radio station and you'd do a session and they bring you in about 15 or 20 commercials and you get a tenner for each commercial and then you go on to another one. It's quite lucrative. And I was in Radio Air in Leeds one day. An old chap called Jeff Sargerson, who was the boss of the station there. And he came up and said, James, he said, what are you doing now? And I said, come back and work for us. Well, we close down at midnight. We want to go 24 hours. Will you do a lot of time? I said, nah, I've done that. It's quite successful. How much money do you want? And he offered me another £3,000 a year. Now, no, so that's a lot of money. We're talking 1980. That's not a bad, you know. So actually, after a long time, and Melinda came down, we had a look around Leeds, and we were travelling back, and we ended up in Harrogate. She said, this is nice. I wouldn't mind living here. And at that time, we had a horse and goats up in Newcastle. We had a nice, you know. And so we moved down into Harrogate. I started working on Radio Air, and I thought, oh, it's never going to happen again, is it? So, and it became successful again.
Stephen, hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I want to talk about love. See, I've got this girlfriend.
Well, Radio Air was a little bungalow next door to Yorkshire Television in Leeds, and it'd just been on a year or so, and there weren't any real sort of celebrities in it, and I went there, and nobody had heard of me. Although I'd done all this before in the Northeast and had spent a year out, if you like. That's all I could stand of the mid-morning show on BBC Derby. And if I ever had to interview another member of the WI about making jam, I think I would have just run out of the first floor window. There was a guy called Carl Kingston. I'm seeing Carl for years and years. Peter Levy, who's on local television and BBC Radio now, is Martin Kellner, Alex Lester, who I've been chatting to and who did a show with on BBC Essex, where I've worked recently, and he went from air to there to do the breakfast show. It's a very incestuous business. So I went to Radio Air, and I did the nighttime show, and it became successful. Then I decided I wanted to get onto television, and one of my good friends at the time was Carol Vorderman. She was doing Countdown and she wanted to be on the radio, and she used to come in and be a guest on the show. And I said to her one day, I'd love to get into TV. And she said, well, go down and meet my agent in London, which I did. And she got me a programme made by Yorkshire Television on Channel 4, which was called The Open College. Me, with no education, doing a kind of open university. It was billed as the Open College, not the Open University. The Open College is kind of student bar on the air, and it was pretty shitty, really. But I presented that with Claudia Winkleman's mum, who was the editor of the Mirror and Express. And I was quite natural on television, and because I'm dyslexic, I can read an auto cue without it looking like I'm reading it. And but anyway, the lady who was presenting with me, the auto cue stopped, and they do sometimes. It's a live show, and I was offset at the time, and she just stopped. So director said to me, James, get on, just do whatever you want to do. Take a couple of the T-shirts we're giving away. And so I went on and did my bit, and they thought it was wonderful and everything else. And the upshot of that was, anyway, eventually I was asked if I'd go and do my radio show on television. And then that happened, and that kind of made me known, if you like, across the country.
Yorkshire Television. Our late night entertainment continues now with a live mix of music and conversation on the James Whale radio show.
It's very nice, good. That's very good, yes. He's cute, isn't he? He's going to be waving at me because I was looking at the wrong flipping camera. So
well, it's the one with the red light on, James. You see?
Don't do that again. One. Yeah, they do that the whole time. They think that's funny, but it isn't very funny.
Nobody had ever done it before, and for the first couple of months, although it ended up as a television show, but we did it as a simulcast. But the radio, at the time, the boss of the radio station became very greedy, and he wanted a lot of money and made it very difficult to fit the commercial breaks in, and didn't like the way that television was trying to lord it over radio, which is pretty silly because, you know, we're talking about a big TV company as opposed to a small, and it could have made them huge. But what happened was I left them and went to work full time for the TV. And my television show, which is interesting, I meet people 25 or so, no idea. And if you look at the bit on the side, Big Brother's bit on the side, that's a bit like my TV show was, but with more, you know, more content, I suppose, talking about various things. And it was like a radio show. We did it like a radio show. We did it live, and I kind of drove it. And in my mind, I was doing, you know, just what I'd always done. In the early days, I did it from my radio studio, and it could have been huge. It's a shame that the radio station didn't embrace it. All they wanted to do was ask for more money for doing it, which is a bit of a shame.
Complete the following well-known phrase or saying, dungeons and... No. Dungeons and... And write it on a postcard and send it to the usual address. Whaley's Mail, care of Yorkshire Television, Television Centre in Leeds. We've got one more.
Yeah, I'm always aware when radio stations have financial difficulties, but I don't think I've ever worked for a commercial radio station that hasn't said it's got financial difficulties, because that's the nature of the beast, isn't it? And you wouldn't say we're doing really well, because I'd say, can I have some more money? So they've always do that. I was worried in the early days that commercial radio wouldn't succeed in this country. I do think, after my long time on the radio, and I'm not an anorak, right? Radio is what I do. It's a job. I have other interests as well. And I often get interested at people who spend their whole lives and hardly ever work on radio. They have much to do, but they know everything about radio, and they go on about radio this and radio that. I come in and I do my show, and then I go. And I like doing what I do, because I've done it for all my life now. But there are people who are so intense and know to... Look, all you need in radio is a good communicator that people want to listen to, and they need to be personalities. There are lots of radio bosses, less now than there were, who don't want personalities, just want people who follow a format. That sort of radio doesn't last very long. And now you can choose your own music better than the radio station, so you know what you want to listen to. The personalities on radio are very important, because that's what people want to listen to. And I cannot believe that we haven't been more successful in speech radio in this country. You go to America, you go to Australia, go to South Africa. They all have more in the way of speech radio than we do. And I wonder if it's because we have a little too prissy and too many people get upset about things and complain. You've got to have some complaints. I would love to find a really great talk show host and mentor them and train them and make money out of them. I'd, you know, be their agent and in the future. That worries me. But the television show went really well and became so successful it knocked Danny Baker's rubbish off the TV, and he's never forgiven me for that. He was doing something, I think, called the Night Network, and that got binned, and then my show went network all over the place. All the time I've been doing that television show, by the way, I had been doing radio. So in the 90s, I was on LBC. At weekends, when they were in Hammersmith, I had a weekend show with a brilliant guy called Bavin, who was my producer. And Bavin was he was very drunk and very gay. Both things I admired in the man. He was very funny. And I would turn up, I'd come down to London, funnily enough, and I would record a couple of the TV shows on a Monday, but I'd come down Friday night and I would do Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon on LBC and then do the TV show. And Bavin's idea was, we'll have a flexi format, dear. Because I'd say, what are we going to do in the show? Oh, don't worry about that, don't worry about that. And I get down and we go to the wine bar, which was opposite the studios, and we sit there and we'd share a bottle of red wine. And I'd say, we're on the air at 2, and it would be 5 to 2. And I'd say, Bav, don't worry, darling, have another glass. And we'll go over to the studios. Bob will be reading the news, and then we can get on with it. And literally, I would slip into the chair in front of the microphone, and the theme tune would come on or whatever, say, hi, welcome to the to Saturday's Afternoon Show, I'm James Well. And Bavin would come in and slip some papers in front of me with what we were going to do. And it was that, and it said, flexi format, dear, it always works, and it keeps you on your toes. And I loved it, and a couple of years doing that. Until, of course, the then LBC lost their licence.
The Radio Authority, which regulates the country's independent radio network, has decided not to renew LBC's franchise for its 2 frequencies.
And I was busy with television. I did Radio London as well for a bit. I did a show on Radio London when it was in Marylebone High Street. I did Atlantic 252, where I went over and did a Sunday morning show from Dublin, and so I kept on doing all of that. And then Talk Radio advertised.
Talk Radio UK on 1053 and 1089 medium wave, the nation's new 24-hour station for talk entertainment.
And at that time I was doing my show called Whale On or something, and from studios in Carnaby Street, and I'd seen an advert for Talk Radio. And so I thought I'd like to do that. In fact, I was getting a bit tired of TV. I've been doing TV non-stop for nearly 10 years. And I thought, I'd quite like to go back to a daily show on the radio. And I went to meet a chap whose name again has gone out of my head. But he was the boss of Talk Radio. And he said to me something along the lines of, you know, well, yeah, you know, but have you ever done any radio? Because quite frankly, we're not really looking for TV celebrities. We want people who've worked on the radio. And I thought, I can't be asked. And I said, I tell you, okay. Well, anyway, listen, I'd be interested. I was not going to tell him because he's not done his research. And then I thought, I was really peeved. And I think I turned around and said something along the lines of, I tell you what, I bet you don't last more than 6 months and then I'll get a job. He said, well, that's not the way to do it. And off I went, flounced out and went back doing my TV show for a while and other things. Anyway, it all fell apart really for them at the beginning. And I got a call, I think it was from Jason Bryant. And I was up in Yorkshire walking out with the dogs and Melinda. I got a call from him saying, hi, right, the good people have taken over Talk. Do you want to come and work? And that was the start of it really. And so I did.
James Whale on Talk Radio UK.
Mike.
Hello, James.
You're on Talk Radio
and
UK.
And we were based in Oxford Street. There we are. Guess what? I'm back doing the nighttime radio show again. And of course, I have been doing radio all the time, but my TV was a late night TV show. So for my entire life, really 30 years at a time, I'd be on television or radio late at night. It's the atmosphere. Before I'm quite happy, by the way, not doing late night. I'm not saying I won't go back to it. All options are always open. But I'm quite enjoying doing a sort of late night show, but early evening at the moment, because I'll get home a bit earlier. And what is it about late night? It's about the atmosphere. It's about people have time to listen. People have time to talk. Live phone calls and chats are not what they used to be because people communicate in different ways and you have to do that. But there's still, you know, radio is about communicating. And I hate that term. It was about communicating. What is it? I don't know what it is, but you can't learn it. So you either have it or you don't have it. And there are lots of people working in radio who don't have it. But then they're probably cheap. It's a shame because you can't get a good communicator because they've got a degree. It doesn't work that way.
Let's go to John from Bradford in West Yorkshire. You're on the air, John.
Ah, good evening, James. Good evening, David.
Hello, John.
My complaint about the radio quality is that I don't...
Kelvin McKenzie used to walk through the corridors of talk radio and he'd say, "Ear whale." I'd say, "Yes, Kelvin." "Are you on the air?" I'd say, "Yeah, why?" "Because I don't have any fucking complaints, that's why." And that was right. You know, it was, you can't go too far over. You've got to know where the line is, and every now and then you might cross the line, and I myself have done on several occasions, but without taking risks, nothing goes forward. So anyway, I was at talk radio and then I got cancer. And that kind of changed things for a while. When Melinda and I won't go through the whole business, but we'd been to see the surgeon and everything else and found out that I could have an operation, but it probably wouldn't work because the tumour was so big and all that sort of stuff. So I hadn't told anybody except my wife and a close family, and we came out the doctors, and she was quite up because it had been quite a depressing time. Although when you're told you're probably going to die, there is a kind of calmness that comes over you. Not for other people, perhaps, but for you, because you know that's how it is, and that everybody will at some point in their lives experience that, I suppose. So we went down to Brighton and booked into the Grand Hotel, took the biggest suite that they had, ordered champagne, and then I rang round everybody and told them, "That's it. I'm checking out fairly soon. I've got kidney cancer. I've got a tumour the size of a football, and that's it." And so I told everybody, and then I get a phone call from Kelvin McKenzie, and his secretary says, "Oh, Kelvin's on the line, he wants to talk to you." And I thought, "Whoa." So he comes on, he said, "What's all this about you having fucking cancer? You're not fucking dying on me, are you? I'm not having that. I've just got the station going the way I want it, and I don't want you checking it. What do you mean you're dying? Don't be ridiculous." And it was really funny, I was pissing myself at the time. And then afterwards, he suddenly says, "Look, you've been good for me." He says, "You've always done a good job. You deliver the audience. Don't worry about anything, mate. Just keep sending me your invoices. You'll get paid. I want you back in 6 weeks." Not many people would behave that way. Actually, just talking about it makes me quite emotional, but that's 17 years ago. So I went back to work after that at talk. I was worried about losing my touch and being nice. Melinda said, "No, that will never happen." And so I thought, what's the most radical thing I can do when I go back on the air? So I brought my surgeon in and we did a talk through the operation on the air. And then I started telling people that, you know, the best thing for healing is a naked breast being rubbed across the scar. And it's just silly stuff like that. And Mrs. W was very good because she used to drive me to work because for a long time I couldn't drive, so I went to the studio. And then afterwards we would go to Stringfellow's, which she likes a lot, which is fine. And Peter Stringfellow has been a really good mate to mine. And he was very good. And we'd turn up and he'd say, like, "Come and have dinner, sit down, James. All right, can he drink?" Bloody well can, yes. You know, if you're going to die, I want to drink. But it was an interesting time. But here, hey-ho, 17 years later. Then, of course, Kelvin lost to a radio and other people took over, and then Mr. Mosdy became the programme director. He'd never like me.
Well, it has to be...
Don't you're not allowed to say.
Say what?
Who you should vote for.
What was I... How do you know what I was going to say?
Well, I know what you're going to say.
Boris Johnson. What?
Did you say something?
What? I didn't say anything.
Boris Johnson. Did you...
Well, no, I didn't say anything. I'm not allowed to say who to vote for in the London mayoral elections. It's wrong.
Well, no, of course not.
Boris Johnson.
Well, I was in France on holiday, and he rang up and said, "Well, we've had a complaint about you saying you're going to support Boris Johnson in the London mayoral elections." Mind you, Boris deserves a good smack now, but that's another story. And I'd say there was a story because Gordon Brown had come out and said he was going to support. And it was just a news story, and I'm just being silly and flippant and saying, well, we need somebody as big as Gordon Brown to support Boris, don't we? Who could that be? Ah, it must be me. I can't remember it. So, anyway, and my then producer, Ash, who still works with me, who can't say that on the air, man, or that sort of thing. And, actually, if I wanted to be a real bastard, I could have blamed it all on him, couldn't I? Because he should have dumped it. But I wouldn't do that. And it was, you know, and we all made mistakes, you know. Interestingly enough, there was only ever one complaint. And I spoke to you. Were you at Ofcom at the time or not? I don't know. But I spoke to some people at Ofcom that I knew. And I said, I've been sacked. He said, that'd be ridiculous. He said, we just want an apology on the air. And it wasn't Ofcom who wanted me sacked at all. They'd said, you know, I'd actually got an email somewhere that gave the wrong dates for the pending time. So I actually thought we weren't in it. But it was such a silly thing to everybody to complain about. Somebody, obviously, and I've got my thoughts on who, somebody in Birmingham, not even connected with the... but anyway, it's done. I fought the case at court and went to court. My barrister came back into the room because, you know, you sit there and he said, right, he said, you're going to win this case, but I want you just to think about this. If, and my whole point was I worked for so long, I should have been given some kind of, you know, written warning. I'd never had a warning in my life about anything. This was the first time I'd ever come into conflict with anyone. Anyway, I bear grudges for a long, long time. I said to the barrister, right, okay, so because, you know, you won't be able to do a job like that as a freelance if this case, blah, blah, blah. So I went and left it. And to be honest, there were lots of good people at Talk. And I'd seen one guy called Bill Ridley, who's still here, who I love, really. And he was walking. And I said, I'd done it because that bloke had annoyed me intently. And I'd suddenly been left without any money. Very difficult, you know, not even, they didn't want to pay. They did have to pay something in the end, you know, but they didn't want to at the time. Melinda was very hurt indeed. Scott Taunton, who's the big boss, and he was away, so I couldn't talk to him, and he'd always been a good chap, and I had a lot of time for him. But some years down the line, anyway, we all got talking again. Bill Ridley kind of acted as an intermediary. Talk Radio has always been my favourite radio station. It's always been my favourite radio station, and now it's owned... I was going to say it's owned by Kelvin McKenzie, and of course that's completely wrong and he's not involved at all, but in a way he is involved, you know, because it's back with that sort of group that Murdoch actually had an interest in it before. And hopefully, although it's early days, I've just come back, I'm just doing 4 days a week and I'm really enjoying it. I'm still doing a show for the BBC and I'm doing a few other things that I'm not going to tell you about.
You're listening to LBC 97.3.
And I believe, you see, I'm pragmatic. Everything is for a reason. I went to do Drive 5 years on LBC, and I still carry around the memo from Richard Park thanking me for putting on an extra 185,000 listeners on the Drive Time show, a rise of 60% or something. I enjoyed doing Drive, really enjoyed it. But, you know, businesses change. A global run stuff in a different way. They didn't really think that I was suitable. I'm not really sure why to this day, but they just, you know, nobody is entitled to a show. And so my contract was coming up. They didn't want to offer me a new contract. So
across the UK, online and on DAB.
Talk Radio.
For those about to talk,
we salute you.
Do you know, when I first came in to the Talk Radio, and I've only been here a couple of months, Talk Radio, so it's fabulous. The Wireless Group, as you know, is now owned by News Corp. I'm sure they will begin to do quite a lot with it. There's all sorts of, you know, radio is the future. Podcasting is the future for a lot of papers as well. Talk radio is very important. There's just LBC, that's it. And I think Talk can do a remarkably great job. I wish I was younger. But, you know, I think in the next few years it will make huge differences. You know, Virgin is back on air. Virgin, as you saw just when you came in. Tonight on my show, I've got a live band. So I'm really enjoying it. I'm absolutely enjoying it. It's great.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
The voice of reason is back. The James Whale Show on Talk Radio. Get in the ring with the legendary James Whale.
Are you ready, man?
He's the king of talk. There ain't none higher. He's gonna keep talking till he expires. Cometh the hour, cometh the whale. Captain Controversy is here. The James Whale Show on Talk Radio. Who loves you, Baldy?
And I only found out I had dyslexia when I was doing a bit on it on my TV show. I used to go out and do little reports on strange things, and I went and took a dyslexia test. And I have a son who is very, because it's hereditary. My mother used to write letters, but she used the first letter and then a scribble. And I often used to wonder why. Well, she couldn't spell, obviously, that's why. And so one of my youngest son, severely dyslexic, he's a chef, very good chef, but he, you know. So I went to the school and they were difficult about it. They said, oh, well, there's no such thing. I said, no, I'd like him to go once a week to the Dyslexia Institute to help him. And they cause all sorts of problems. And even today, you talk about it, people will say, oh, no, there's no such thing. Dyslexia doesn't. There are many forms of dyslexia. You know, when I was at school, you're thick, you're stupid, you're in the bottom run because you can't spell. And because you can verbalise your thoughts, you're difficult. Because I'll take on a teacher. A teacher says to me, sit down and be quiet. I'll say, why? Because I say so. Sorry, that's not a good enough reason. Maybe that's where my kind of abruptness on my radio shows came from. Maybe I'm playing the part of the teacher. But you see, you can't do what I do without a certain amount of charm and a certain amount of your tongue stuck in your cheek, and listeners have got to hear it. Because there are some people around and I who think they're brilliant talk show hosts who couldn't get arrested now because they're just nasty and vile and try to just be shocking. I don't like the term shock jock. It's a stupid term used by lazy journalists. That's another thing that I went on the Howard Stern show many years ago once and, you know, went over to New York. I wanted to see what that was all about and found just listening to his show how similar to what I did. It was just chatting to people and sometimes a bit risque, sometimes a bit naughty. Sometimes there's somebody you disagree with, but it's kind of developed. You know, he goes on the air. He used to go on the air and say, I don't know when we're going to finish. I'll see how I feel. And that was it in my mind. That was always it, you know.
Very good evening to you. The James Whale Radio Show here Thursday night. Last of our nightly shows for this week. Of course, tomorrow night it's the legendary George Galloway who fills this slot. And I tell you, George will have a lot to say about the impending inauguration of President Donald Trump. My golly. Good evening. Good evening.
I've no interest really in legacy, I suppose. Although I was having a joke the other day with Alan Brazil and George Galloway, funnily enough, because I got George Galloway into radio and he is great. And Alan Brazil came to me and he was telling me, he said, oh, I was indicted into the Radio Hall of Fame and I gave you a big mention. I said, really? I didn't even know there was a Radio Hall of Fame. Nobody's ever asked me to go in there. He said, oh, right. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. Sorry, it didn't upset me. I don't give a bloody care one way or the other. I probably wouldn't be invited anyway because I was invited once by the Radio Academy. And I went with the late Mike Dickin, bless him.
In that if you say I don't believe in God, you're all of a sudden, you're some sort of a murderer. You're some sort of a person without sensitivity, without feeling, without morals.
And they wanted me to go and talk about, you know, risque phone-in radio. And at the time, I... Oh, what? Okay. I'm going to miss the bill if I come along and do this. And Dickin said, all right, it'll be fine. We're going to do it. And me and Mike Dickin on the panel, a bloody Edwina Curry. And they're all talking. And most of the people in the Radio Academy came from the BBC. There we are. There's a surprise. I was in a fairly petulant mood anyway when I went in, because I do hate people trying to analyse what is an abstract art in a way. Because I'll go on the air tonight. I don't know where it's going to take me. And some whippersnappers from the BBC who apparently produces and And they're all talking about what makes it good, and this is what makes it, and you have to do this, and you have to know that, and it's all rubbish. I mean, really, it's rubbish. You want to make a good phone-in program. If phone-in programs exist like that anymore, you know, you have to engage somebody in that. You have to talk about things that makes them want to talk in. And it's, and they're talking about it in sort of a way as if there's a format. There is no format. And Edwina Curry gets up and says something. She was doing radio too, wasn't she, at the time? She said, I want to thank Mr. James Well, got me into radio, and... because I did, actually.
Women get it in the neck when they are ambitious or able or stray.
And she was quite good. I had her as a guest at Radio Air in Leeds and took her out for a curry, curry as curry, purely to get into the papers and get some publicity. And the question was, I said, right, James, can you tell what makes good, what makes an interesting phone? I thought, I don't really know. I wonder if the audience have got any, some little pillock in the front. I'm saying, I work on Solent Radio and I think you're just terrible. I don't even like what you do. And I don't think what you do is very good radio. Oh, I said, right, OK, why don't you come up here and take over then? Because you obviously know a lot more than me, Pratt, don't you? Come and do that. I got up, got my coat and walked out. You could have heard a pin drop. That makes good radio. But they didn't realise. They didn't actually understand. I got a call from one of the organisers saying, James, we're very disappointed with what you did. Very disappointed. And quite frankly, we won't be inviting you again. I said, I don't care. And that was it. And that was, what, 20-odd years ago. I think that's probably why I'm not a member of the, what is it, the Radio Hall of Fame or something along those lines. I should be recognised for something, shouldn't I?
Lewis and James, you have both lost your place in the Celebrity Big Brother house. You will be leaving.
Lots of people say how much money people get on, and there's a rumour going around saying, you know, you get about £20,000. I'm not going to tell you how much I got, and my wife spent it, but when I thought about it, I thought, well, I could just not work for a few years. And my agent convinced me, said, if you go in and you keep quiet, you'll be out in a week. Was I hell? And in fact, when I was up for eviction, I've still got the record for the most calls to save me. But you know, it's up to the, if you keep a low profile, you don't do much, then you can get out. But why did I do it? Well, I did it, A, for money, obviously. B, because it's rather interesting. I quite like reality TV. Phone-in radio was the original reality television, obviously. And it was an experience. And now I've done it once, I'd quite like to have a go at doing it again somewhere. I don't know. Probably not Strictly Come Dancing. It was interesting. It messes with your mind. And you have to be quite strong to deal with it. It's not as it seems, right? 24 hours a day with people you probably wouldn't get on with normally. You don't know what's going on in the outside world. You don't get out of the place. You've no idea what's happening, and if you are getting on quite well with somebody, the producers will throw a spanner in the works to make sure that you don't. Fascinating. Fascinating. And it brought me to a new audience who no idea who James Whale is. You know, I'm not a household name, but I'm probably better known than I think I am sometimes. I've never really wanted to be famous, but you have to be famous to actually get certain jobs. And in the early days, you have to have a bit of publicity to get people to know where you are to listen to your radio show. And that was another reason for doing it, because I thought, I'd been sort of talking to people at Talk Radio before I went in there and everything else. And I thought, well, I'll go in there first and then I'll see what happens, because radio is my first love. Television's a different kind of thing, but radio is king.